Hey guys, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Well, dang, the Liberty Crier just arrived in my email box. I bet you there's a bunch of great stuff in here. I hope you guys are signed up for the Liberty Crier email. You know, I had to make a habit out of interviewing Trevor Lyman. He does such great work over there. Always police state stories that blow your mind and knock your socks off there at libertycrier.com. That one again. All right, anyway, so I'm Scott Horton. I got a good show lined up for you today. And, definitely go to Liberty Crier today. He's got a ton of great stuff there. Let's see if maybe we can get to some of that a little bit later on. Oh, yeah, no, we won't, because we got three interviews. We got Olivia Watson on Palestine, Rory Fanning on being an Army Ranger, and Roy Guttman on the war against ISIS. Roy had that story a couple of days back in McClatchy about the approximately 50 people killed when the Americans bombed an ISIS jail. And killed at least 50 innocent people. And so anyway, talk with him about that. We'll talk with him about the Turks and the Free Syrian Army. And in fact, let me go ahead and make sure I go ahead and just put Roy Guttman in Google News here, because he's actually had quite a few stories I'd like to follow up recently here regarding the FSA, regarding Turkey, and regarding, wow, the Guttman Report. I didn't realize that there was that. The Yemen Times, the Guttman Report. Anyway, yeah. Oh, and I guess he's covering the young lady who was supposedly the accomplice of the Paris shooters as well, since she fled supposedly through Turkey to Syria. Oh, and this is the other one I was looking for. U.S., Turkey, agree to Syrian rebel training, but not whom they'll fight. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of complicated there, ain't it? All right, so that's coming up. A little bit of war coverage for you there. Later on in the week, other guests on other things. All right. Now, since I reported this story yesterday, somebody else reported it. I just told you about it. And I think I built in plenty of caveats, didn't I? I think I was even joking when I was reading about it. This sounds like it was somebody at the Pentagon hacking the Pentagon. There's a Daily Beast story. Wrong Daily Beast story. There's a Daily Beast story. ISIS hackers love American folk punk, don't know the name of their own terror group. And this is at, the Daily Beast. Oh, it's by Nancy Youssef and Jacob Siegel. And it's about how ISIS, they don't call themselves ISIS. And so that would be your first clue. And then they went to this guy's, the hackers, where they posted all the stuff to their Facebook page. And they saw how they were, one of the seven Twitter accounts it followed was Andrew Jackson Jihad, a folk punk band from the American Southwest. Folk punk from the Southwest, huh? All right. Well, anyway. So whoever it was that did it, it wasn't the Islamic State. And all the stuff that they posted up apparently was all open source stuff. Did I tell you it didn't look all that impressive? I don't know. I was fooled because I saw one of these pseudo-terrorism experts on. I was fooled a little. I saw one of these terrorism. I was building in caveats the other way. I don't know. It might be something. Here, I think it was J.M. Berger was saying, oh, yeah, look at what the stuff they're posting. But then, like I told you, it's just email addresses and stuff. I don't see bank accounts or wives' names. Or then again, I didn't download all the zip files. I don't know what all they posted. But anyway, it very well could have just been, a military op to hack their own stupid Twitter feed for a minute to help get the next law passed. Or it could have just been any old random hackers and nobody knows. But apparently, it was not. the Islamic State. All right. Sometimes I don't like to hit refresh on antiwar.com. What a bunch of bad news. You know what? I want to spend the rest of this segment praising my sponsors. I would hope that you would help support the sponsors of this show. If you like the interviews, if you like hearing me rant and rave about things that I hate on here, then help support Buy the War State by Michael Swanson. It's at Amazon.com. Stop by scottwarden.org/Amazon to get to it. Also, wallstreetwindow.com. That's the same author, Mike Swanson, who gives great investment advice. That's all he sells is advice. He's not trying to hook you up and become your broker now or anything like that. I'll leave that to others. He just gives advice. Wall Street Window, he just announces all of his trades and lets you see what he's doing and explains why. And if you got some assets and you want to protect them, it's probably a pretty good bet to turn to Mike Swanson at wallstreetwindow.com for some good advice there. And then, of course, there's the Council for the National Interest. That's Phil Giraldi's group pushing for a peaceful foreign policy there in Washington, D.C. Then there's Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc., which those are the traders that you're looking for there. Once you decide you want to follow Mike Swanson's advice, that's when you pick up the phone and you call Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc., and they will help sort it out as you, buy any kind of precious metal, gold, silver, platinum, palladium, and for a very modest fee. And they've been around for as long as I've been alive or so, and they do good work there. That's RRBI.co, and that's for Roberts and Roberts Brokerage, Inc. There's Darren's Coffee at darrenscoffee.com. Of course, the Future Freedom Foundation, which is awesome coffee. And by the way, Darren, send me some more coffee. By the way, I had some company over, and they really liked it. It's really good. And he gives free shipping, which I think means he's sending you this stuff at a loss in order just to help support this show. He's at free shipping. The first deal was $2 off. And he said, no, you know what? Make it free shipping. Which is no matter how much you buy, I guess, as long as you use my promo code, which is, I forgot, Scott or Scott Horton. Make sure the promo code is kicking in there. Darren'sCoffee.com. It's really great, and they got all different kinds from all over the world and all of the very select grade and all that kind of thing. Okay, and then, of course, LibertyStickers.com and TheBumperSticker.com. I invented them, but then I sold them to Rick so I could do this instead, and he's kept them going for a good decade plus now. He's made one hell of a great company. I knew it, guys. Let me tell you something. A bumper sticker company, huh? Let me tell you something. This thing ain't going to last a year. Yeah, really? Well, that's funny because you told me that 10 years ago, dude. How's your sticker company doing? Anyway, thebumpersticker.com and libertystickers.com. That's where I put my hateful slogans on vinyl for you, libertystickers.com. And then Whole Food Multicomplete is sponsoring the show. I got a deal going with Audible.com. If you want to do an Audible trial, go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. You get your first book free, and I get a kickback. So why not get The War State on audiobook? There you go, audible.com. audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Liberty.me, join up and be my friend there. Follow the link from my page, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback. It's just $5 a month now. You sign up for Liberty.me. My Heroes Think to get little 7 or 9 inch busts of Ron Paul, Harry Brown, Murray Rothbard, and soon Hazlitt, Hayek, and Carlin. LibertyClassroom.com, of course, the heroic Tom Woods. Ron Paul at Voices of Liberty is playing my show. And QR code commodity discs are silver pieces with QR codes on the back to tell you the instant spot price. And then, of course, there's offnow.org, the project of the 10th Amendment Center. So go support and or patronize all those things I just said, please. Thank you.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And so, yeah, like I was saying, Olivia Watson on Palestine, Rory Fanning on his role in the war in Afghanistan, and Roy Guttman on ongoing goings-on in the Syrian side of the ISIS war. For this part of the show... it's time to focus on police state news here. Hotter than lava. Is that really right? Did Julia Angwin and Abby Nehring, did they double check and triple check with the university professor about that? Is that really right? Hotter than lava. The explosives in a flashbang grenade. Oh, yeah. See, we talked about this yesterday, and I brought up the great clip of Charles Schumer, Bob Barr, and Jim Kavanaugh, the ATF tangling over whether a flashbang amounted to a lethal weapon or not. Damn right. And I finally had a chance, because I saw the article on Twitter during the show yesterday. I had a chance to read the whole thing last night, and I'm working on getting Julia Angwin on the show if I can. But man, it's really something else. And I guess, you know, the thing that hit me the most about, well, there are two things that hit me the most about it, is just how often the cops use flashbang grenades. And that is all night, every night, in black parts of town, all over this country, almost exclusively, not exclusively, but almost exclusively, poor black people, victims of drug raids that, and blacks don't use drugs any more than white people do. It's just they don't have any political power, typically speaking. And so they're low-hanging fruit for the cops. It's easier to get away with. It's less likely they're going to act when they kill somebody that it's going to turn out it's the daughter of a judge or somebody who could get them in real trouble, you know? So they just go ahead and take it out on the powerless who happen to be black, as George Carlin would say. And then the other thing that got me was the update on the story of Little Bobo, who was the 3-year-old toddler that the SWAT team in Atlanta, Georgia, it was a drug task force, whatever the hell, they threw a flashbang grenade which exploded on the pillow right in his face, and it destroyed his nose and his lips, and, he doesn't need to close his mouth, don't worry about it. It destroyed his face, and it punctured a hole straight through his chest into his lung and punctured his lung. The doctors put him in a coma to save him, a deliberate coma to save him the trauma, because the trauma and the shock of his injuries would have killed him. So the doctors kept him in a coma for almost a month. And now he's recovering, and of course the government of all jurisdictions involved in Georgia there have told the family to go to hell, that they have no right to have their medical expenses covered or anything else. But here's the important part. Baby Bobo, this 3-year-old toddler, this helpless, perfectly, by definition, perfectly innocent, helpless human being, wakes up screaming every night, clutching his mouth. His mother says, it's like he's remembering what happened. Yeah, that time his protectors, the police, threw a grenade at his face and blew it off. He wakes up screaming every night. So, you know, because the greatest generation insists that we gotta have a war on drugs, or else someone they know might know someone who knows someone who might have a bad reaction from the marijuana they heard on TV, they think. And because it's just a fun way for cops to go around brutalizing people and revenuing for their betters. From their betters to their higher uppers. That's what I mean to say. And anyway, so there you go. You thought the story of Baby Bobo was over, but it's not for him. It's not for his mom. Hey, are you somebody's mom? Or do you have a wife who's the mom of your kids? How do you think she'd feel if that's what the cops did? Somebody in your family. How would your kid feel? How would grandma feel? Anyway, I know it's insane to ask Americans to put themselves in even other Americans' shoes for even an instant. Oh, come on. Horrible pain and grief and violence and death is perfectly fine as long as it's all happening to somebody else. What do I care? You all shrug. I know. I get it. For example, this jury in South Carolina, can you believe that the same day that Eric Garner's executioner was no-billed, executioners were no-billed, a grand jury in South Carolina actually indicted a cop for murder. Can you believe that? Well, the jury just let him go. Mistrial, meaning at least one juror said, cops can kill whoever they want, I don't care. And the prosecutors say, hey, in this case, there's just really no question that this citizen angered the cop, who then hunted him down and killed him, and pretended that the guy was trying to run him over when he wasn't trying to run him over, he was just trying to leave. And I guess there's so many different chances where the cop could have disengaged or whatever. I don't know. Maybe somehow. Oh, you know what it is? It's the guy that he killed was a former corrections officer. That's what it was. The guy that he killed was a 54-year-old former actual human being. See, even though he was black, he was a former cop himself. So therefore, he had a right to not be murdered by a cop. The prosecutor mused that, you know, possibly. And then the jury said no. The jury said, nope, he's a cop. He can murder whoever he wants and let him go. That's the rule of law in America for you there. Another great police state story from Pete Brook at Wired.com. The Josh Begley prison map. A guy named Josh Begley went and he typed in the coordinates to all the prisons into Google Earth and blam, here they are. 5,300 of them. Between 2.2 and 2.5 million Americans locked in cages like animals. And as it says here, mostly these prisons are built in rural America. As a consequence, many of these facilities are located in small towns, deserts, and remote corners of states with lots of space. They're out of sight and out of mind. Prison map reveals this vast hidden infrastructure. This is no different than Americans talking about the slaves of the Soviet Union. Only it's us. Because America's the evil empire. Get it? In fact, when Dennis Rodman was being interviewed, oh, don't you know that Kim Jong-un has 200,000 people in his prison camps? And Dennis Rodman, he's interviewed on TV News, says, America has 2.2 million people in their prison camps, so? And the Fox News guy or MSNBC guy said, no. Yeah, no, you don't. Or care, either.
Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest is Olivia Watson. She is with, Well, let's see. It's Defense for Children International Palestine. And I guess they have their separate divisions here. This is the Palestine division. The website is DCI-Palestine.org. DCI-Palestine.org. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks, Scott.
Good. Very happy to have you here on the show. Looks like you guys are doing some very important work here. I saw someone had sent out an article that about some work that you guys had done last summer about Palestinian children in solitary confinement. And I see that you guys have some follow-up here as well on the site. So I might ask you about that a little bit later. But first of all, I kind of wanted to run through this. And I guess that's one of the stories on the list anyway, isn't it? You've got this great write-up, kind of retrospective here. How was 2014 for Palestinian children? Well, we know the answer is terrible, but obviously, first and foremost, the answer starts with the war in the Gaza Strip, or war against the Gaza Strip last summer, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the interesting thing here is that a lot of media attention obviously focused on the conflict in Gaza over the summer. But what DCI Palestine was observing was that fatalities and injuries of children were continuing like way before that started, and they continue now as well.
Right. All right. Well, so then let's go back then to a year ago, the beginning of the year, the first half of the year, really, before the war started. What was going on then?
So the buffer zone that it closes the Gaza Strip is very heavily militarized. And we observed three child fatalities in the run-up to the Gaza conflict. So those were in March, April, May. And those were children just continuing with their lives. Often they were mistakenly on the agricultural section which borders the buffer zone. And Israeli soldiers were opening fire, and there were three fatalities and 43 injuries as a result of Israeli fire in the months preceding the conflict.
And by the way, because we probably won't get back to it, there was a point during the war where the buffer zone was shrunk by severe degrees by the IDF. Did they keep it that way, or did they retreat back to the former line?
There was some retreating, but it's still not at the level that it was before the conflict at the moment. So there's been even more of a squeeze, if you like, on the Gaza Strip.
And that's all the best land.
That's the agricultural land, yeah, that people need to survive. Conditions are very hard in Gaza, obviously, and people need to have access to that agricultural land to live. Mm.
And so you're talking about children being shot, but how is it that the IDF justifies shooting children who are just wandering too close to the line, right? It's not like they're trying to climb the fence into Israel. They're just wandering too close to the line and they're getting sniped?
Yeah, I mean, Israel has basically no justification for it. I mean,
not that it would be okay to shoot a kid climbing the fence. I didn't mean to say it that way.
No, of course not. But there's very little justification for it. I mean, in the cases that DCI Palestine documented, children were trying to take in sheep that they'd allowed to graze on the land. They were collecting hay, that kind of thing. They weren't posing any kind of threat. And there's absolutely no justification for shooting at children in those circumstances.
Yeah, it's just terrible. And then, so now how many children were killed in the war?
So DCI Palestine documented at least 480. It depends. The UN thinks over 500 children lost their lives. But yeah, it was at least 480 children.
I saw one statistic that had, at least a couple of score of family lines completely destroyed, where no member of the family lived, and their last name is over for now, or their branch of whatever family is over.
Yeah, and there was one family in which the extended family was at home at the time of an attack, and the extended family lost 19 children in the same attack. This was because buildings were being targeted and families were living in close proximity with one another. So lots and lots of children were present when houses were being bombed.
And now, of course, the Israelis say, well, you know, we're only shooting back where Hamas is shooting rockets at us. And it's the Palestinians' fault for being nearby or for allowing Hamas to fire rockets from near where they're staying. Is that not correct?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what they say. But I think if you have any understanding of the demographics and the context of the Gaza Strip, I mean, this is an incredibly densely populated area. Half of the population is under 18. So wherever you are, there are going to be large numbers of children. And they're penned in. You know, we've already talked about the buffer zone. People can't get in and out. So they're trapped. And so it's, I think it's misleading to talk about Hamas fighters embedded within the population. I mean, that's to ignore the context completely.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, they say that everything is a very carefully targeted strike, and yet they're using 500 and 1,000 pound bombs. And you can see from the footage where they've just decimated entire sections of town. How the hell do you call that a precise strike when, you know, it amounts to carpet bombing?
Yeah, indeed. And they're also targeting, you know, residential areas. I mean, whole neighborhoods of Gaza City were flattened, like Shijaya to the east of Gaza City. It's very densely populated. It's residential areas. And yeah, as you say, they were bombing civilian neighborhoods.
And I'm sorry, I always mess it up. What is it called? The Shia Doctrine or something like that, named after the neighborhood in Lebanon where they decided, let's just collectively punish this entire neighborhood by leveling it.
Yeah, the Dahiya Doctrine. Yeah, that was followed during the Gaza conflict, yeah. I mean, and that was one of the reasons for the very high loss of life of civilians and of children.
Yeah, it's amazing that they're allowed in any media to get away with pretending that everything is a targeted strike against somebody firing a rocket at the same time that it's on the record that they have this doctrine of collective punishment, and then they carry it out before our eyes. Although, would you agree, Olivia, that something that was really different this time around, and we have these periodic bloodlettings in Gaza, but that this time around, the ability of the average Gazan to put the pictures on Twitter had increased to such a degree that it really turned the tide, and in terms of public relations, the Israeli lies just weren't holding up to the reality coming, you know, to our desktops in real time.
Well, I wouldn't say that it turned the tide. I mean, it was definitely gave a much more balanced view of what was actually happening on the ground in Gaza. But I think one of the problems with the way the media portrayed the whole conflict was that it was portrayed as an equal battle, an equal fight between Hamas and Israel, when that's not at all the case. So there are still problems with the way the media portrays the conflict. But yeah, at the very least, people could see what was happening in Gaza from people who were there, who were living through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember even John Stewart, who is pretty much silent on this issue most of the time, got in on the act and mocked how they were on CNN, I guess, interviewing two reporters, one from Gaza and one from Tel Aviv. And the one from Gaza is wearing a body armor and a helmet, and the guy in Tel Aviv is wearing a pink polo shirt. And but we're supposed to pretend that it's the Israelis who are the ones under siege.
Yeah. I mean, that perfectly encapsulated how unbalanced the whole conflict was. You know, and when there was that many bombs being dropped on the Gaza Strip repeatedly over the course of 50 days. I mean, just to look at the numbers, it's clear that it was a completely unbalanced conflict. So over 2,200 Palestinians lost their lives, as opposed to approximately 70 Israelis, most of whom were soldiers as well. And as we know, the majority of Palestinians who died were civilians. So it's not balanced at all, no.
All right, now hold it right there, y'all. We'll be right back with Olivia Watson from DCI-Palestine.org, Defense for Children International, Palestine. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Olivia Watson from Defense of Children International Palestine. That's DCI-Palestine.org. DCI-Palestine.org. And we're kind of doing a year in review here of Israel's treatment of Palestinian children. And so that goes for the Gaza Strip as well as the West Bank. And I guess before we move right on to the solitary confinement story, could you please discuss for us here real quick, tell us about this instance of the Israelis using a Palestinian child as a human shield in the war in Gaza, because that's all we ever heard from the Israelis about why they kill, who they kill in the Gaza Strip is, hey, if it's funny the way they say it too, they go, oh, Hamas uses these human shields, but it's sort of unsaid that it's okay to go ahead and wax them. If they're being used as a shield, then by all means, shoot right through them to kill the Hamas guy on the other side. As we already discussed, there doesn't necessarily have to be a Hamas guy anywhere nearby for them to go ahead and do it. But so then we turn right around and we have, I don't know if there's a single actual proven case of Hamas using Palestinian civilians as human shields, but you guys have at least one here of the Israeli military in this same engagement. Can you please explain?
Yeah, so we found that the Israeli military had detained 16-year-old Ahmed Abu Raida during the conflict. He was detained for 5 days, separated from his family, and detained for no reason. He's a child, of course, and he's not involved in any military activities. During his detention, he was beaten with a wire. He was made to walk in front of soldiers searching for tunnels inside the Gaza Strip. And he was also made to dig outside in the sun on behalf of soldiers, as well as being made to go in front of soldiers inside houses to check for any booby traps, any bombs that might be in the house already. And I mean, that's effectively to protect Israeli soldiers. So, yeah, he was, I mean, it's a very clear case of using a Palestinian child as a human shield, and it flouts international law. We took an affidavit from both the boy who was involved and from people who saw him, other detainees who saw him during the 5 days that he was detained. Mm-hmm. But as yet, the Israeli government hasn't launched any investigation into this, and he hasn't been contacted for comment from the Israeli military.
Well, and how much of the story was verified by those external witnesses?
I mean, all of it is verified. Yeah, I mean, it's to us, it's very clear. But we have the Israeli military on the other side who deny the fact that that he was used in that way, and who haven't yet undertaken a proper investigation into it at all.
Right. Yeah, because they don't want to know what it's going to find. That's pretty obvious enough there. All right. So now to the solitary confinement, and you know, I'm an individualist, so good thing, because if I was just speaking for America, boy, would this be a matter of the pot calling the kettle black. But each individual injustice stands on its own. Please tell us about solitary confinement of minors, of children, by the Israeli police and military.
Yep. So just to give you a bit of background, there are approximately 200 children in military detention on average every month in the West Bank. So of those children detained, some are subjected to solitary confinement. And that's normally as a way of coercing a confession or extracting information. And of the cases that we've documented, we find that children are placed alone in a cell, normally without windows. They're given restricted food and water, not very much, and they're placed there for up to sometimes 2 weeks, just completely alone, with a view to extracting information perhaps about other people in the community, or forcing a confession that may or may not be true. And I mean, between 2008 and 2013, we documented 80 cases of Palestinian children subjected to solitary confinement like that. And that's prior to them being charged with any offence at all. So they're not actually charged when they're being placed in solitary confinement like that. Obviously, using solitary confinement in that way is conduct that amounts to torture under international law. When it's intentionally used like that during pre-trial detention as a technique to obtain a confession, it amounts to torture, it's cruel, it's inhumane, and it's degrading as well. We also found that children held in that way in solitary confinement are not being properly informed of their right to silence, and they're denied access to legal counsel, and they don't have a family member present during interrogation. So there's various ways in which children's rights are being violated. Obviously, the most serious one is to be kept like that for days on end in solitary confinement, which is extremely traumatic for a child.
It's absolutely amazing. And I think Americans, all Americans have a very simple touchstone here, which is our Fifth Amendment, which provides that the government may not even attempt to, they can ask you, but they can't do anything other than ask you once, and they have to shut up and leave you alone once you ask for your lawyer to get you to incriminate yourself. There is no process under American law. It's banned by our Bill of Rights for them to try to force a confession out of you, because it's been that way since 1791, because they were applying the lessons of the past. And what you're describing to me is, just think of this process. Everyone listen to this process. They arrest a kid, then they put him in solitary confinement, then they get his confession, then they charge him. They're not even, never mind he's been convicted and sentenced to solitary confinement, which would be the worst kind of human rights violation in the first place. But here we're talking about, this is how they come up with the bogus story about what the kid did that they're going to use to charge him in the first place. You know, even in America now, they couldn't do this to a kid.
And I think the issue as well is that these types of confessions that are being coerced from children are used as if they're as evidence in a military court. So judges routinely take evidence that's been obtained in that way by a coercive confession and use it to sentence the child. And the vast majority of children are found guilty for the charges that they're accused of.
Amazing. And you know what? I shouldn't speak with too broad of a brush. I'm sure there are kids in jail right now in America who have been subject to this same kind of thing. But it's certainly against the spirit of our laws and what all Americans, this is the one thing we agree on is the Bill of Rights supposedly around here and the justice that and the truth and freedom it's supposed to protect here. And that's, torture's banned twice, really, in our Bill of Rights, the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, and then also again in the Eighth Amendment against using it as a punishment. Now, when we're talking about these minor Palestinians, how young of children are we talking about are being subject to this kind of treatment by the Israelis?
The vast majority are teenagers, maybe 15, 16, but some are as young as 12. We've had cases of even younger children being arrested as well. I think it's also important to note that it's not just the fact of being held in solitary confinement. It's also that interrogations continue throughout that period. So they can continue sometimes for weeks. The interrogations are extremely threatening. Normally the child is alone. And they're intimidated verbally, physically. So it's a very, very coercive environment for extracting confession. And these are young children, they're 14, 15, and they're not at all equipped to be able to deal with this. It's extremely traumatic for them.
Yeah, their families are threatened. Is that part of it too?
The families are completely absent. So they're normally arrested during the night and taken away from their parents. They're not given access to legal counsel. And normally the first time they see their parents again is when they appear in the military court.
Yeah. As part of the confession, if you don't confess, we're going to do this, that, or the other thing to your family, that kind of thing.
We've had cases of that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, that sounds, for some reason, I think that sounds to people like it's not that much of a thing if they don't do it. But you think about anyone, but especially a child who's being held under the total power of these people. And they're saying, yeah, we can do the same thing and worse to those closest to you. That's a credible threat. That can cause the, absolute most extreme levels of stress, especially in a child. A threat like that against, their family members, their mother, their father, their brothers, their sisters. It's just madness. If this was any other country in the world that was not an ally of the United States, America would invade it and regime change it for using these kinds of human rights abuses as their excuse to do so. And it would be a pretty much open and shut case as far as the American people are concerned, too. But anyway.
I think it's fairly clear that that international law is being just flouted again and again in terms of military detention of children in Israel.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, I ran and raved so much, and we didn't get a chance to talk about all the rest of this horrible oppression here, including the absolute impunity with which the settlers unleash their violence on the people whose land they're stealing in the occupied territories there. But that'll have to wait for another time. But thank you so much for your time on the show, Olivia. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure, Scott. Thanks.
It's Olivia Watson at dci-palestine.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, well, I don't know what the hell happened, but I can't reach our guest. I guess I'll try him again in 10 minutes and we'll see how it goes then. I don't know. Hey, these things happen. It's a live radio show, man. So people get time zones mixed up, or, you know, they get a flat tire, or their phone runs out of juice, or they listen to an earlier segment in the show and decide... No, I don't think that's ever happened. It could. I wouldn't dismiss the possibility. But anyway, no, I don't know. Anyway, so I'm trolling through Twitter during the break there, and I see Reason is picking a fight with Ron Paul. They say Rand Paul will never be president as long as Ron Paul's alive, right? So instead of my more realistic take that Rand Paul sucks and he'll never be president because his last name is Paul, no matter how bad he panders to the war party and wages war against even the premise of principle and carves out a name for himself where he's known most for being a flipper flopper on everything. Oh, flipper flopper. That's all he ever does about everything. And where his father's known as a truth teller or a kook or whatever you think of him, he's known as meaning what he says. Rand is not. And he could never be the president anyway. Give me a break. But anyway, so they want to pretend that the reason he can't be the president is because his father is just such a kooky old guy. You know, never mind Matt Welch, who was a war blogger who coined himself, "I'm a war blogger." For the Iraq war, when Ron Paul said, hey, this is a blowback and this war is going to cause some more of it. Matt Welch knew better. And anyway, Ron Paul has put out this piece, and I guess I would concede that he shouldn't have used the word fantasy. It's a fantasy to say that the attack on Charlie Hebdo has anything to do with free speech. I'm not sure if that's the exact statement, but something along those lines. It's an overdone statement. But I absolutely agree with the point that he's trying to make. And of course, Matt Welch just dodges it. He doesn't even argue the point, really. He just ignores it. He points out that, yes, obviously these guys were targeted for what it was that they were saying. Yeah, that's true. But that's not why they were targeted. Don't you get it? It's a war. When Al-Qaeda attacked America on September 11th, they could have attacked a lot of different targets. Why did they choose the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? Oh, because those are symbolic of American power. And they wanted to hit symbols of American power, so they chose those targets in their attack on the United States. That was blowback for George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton and George W. Bush slaughtering Iraqis from bases in Saudi Arabia and supporting Israel's endless occupations of Lebanon and Palestine at the time. That's why they did it. And they chose the targets that they chose for reasons also. But to pretend that the reason for the attack is simply these guys pushing free speech and insulting other people's religions is completely retarded and stupid. And that's why Matt Welch doesn't even engage Ron Paul's argument, which is that these guys were radicalized by the war in Iraq. Otherwise, they were just Joe and Tom, French, third-generation Muslim Algerian. What do they have to do with anything terrorist? What do they have to do with anything Islamic other than solidarity with other Muslims being killed? And just like the Israeli and Saudi studies said in 2005, it's the war that's radicalizing a whole new generation. We looked at Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and none of these are old guys from the Afghan war in the 80s when they worked for Ronald Reagan. These guys are all young guys. The only thing that old Al-Qaeda has to do with it is raising the money and arranging the travel. But you have young, this is 10 years ago, 2005, America's Iraq War II. You have Saudis, you have Libyans, Egyptians, Syrians, and others from around the region going to Iraq to fight to kill the Americans. As Matthew Alexander said on the show, he was the interrogator who interrogated 2,300 of them in the space of a year. Was that the number? Was it 3,200 of them in the space of a year? They all were there because they were taking the side of their fellow Sunni Muslims who were being persecuted by the American-backed Shia and by the Americans who were being tortured, who were being killed, who were being driven out of their homes and out of their oil wealth and power. And they came to join up. None of them joined up because religion made them hate good things. And these guys, these two brothers accused in the French attacks, they were part of that exact same phenomenon. You read about it in the Christian Science Monitor or in the Boston Globe. Just type in 2005 Saudi-Israeli studies. There's two different studies, and it's Israeli scholars who said, hey, blowback, in real time. That's who these guys are. And then, come on, even the French cops are saying that these guys were on the side of the United States and France in our proxy war, so-called secret war, in Syria for the last 3 years, that they went and fought there last summer. They admit it, even though it implicates their own government, too, not just ours. It's their policy, too. As I've been telling you on the show, for 4 years straight, because Eric Margolis said so. From 2011 on, he said, we got French special forces working on regime change in Syria right now with these Mujahideen. In 2011, he said so. I'll admit it's about 4.5 years. I think it was the summer of 2011 he said that. They got started a little bit late in Syria after they had Libya first. Anyway. Of course, man, even assuming the official story here that these guys were recruited by Al-Qaeda in Yemen, who I'm sure Reason Magazine would agree. Wouldn't they agree that Al-Qaeda in Yemen has been built up by the American drone war there? Everybody knows that, man. That's in freaking Newsweek, man. Leon Panetta admitted that was true on Meet the Press to David Gregory. Yes, it's true. Every time we drone strike someone, we create even more enemies and we make Al-Qaeda even more powerful. But these are the tools we have, David Gregory, and so we're going to continue to use them. Use your Google, Welch. They say that it was Al-Qaeda in Yemen that sent this guy to do this. Well, America's got a war with them. You want to narrow this whole thing down to just someone was offended by a cartoon? That's how they picked their target. We need to attack France. Who do we want to attack in France? Asked the writers of Inspire magazine, the Al-Qaeda magazine out of Yemen. Here's a great French target to target, they said. Come on, man. This is stupid. As though Ron Paul is wrong that this is blowback from Iraq and Syria. That's an absolute certifiable fact. And for Welch to ignore it is a worse error than Ron Paul's language, and I think he probably had help with the article. It's too stark of language to say it had nothing to do with free speech. And in fact, though, that's only the part they quote. I should go back and double-check the piece, because it's just as likely that he explained in context what he meant here. Let's see, Lessons from Paris. It's on antiwar.com today as well. I'm sure he has something in here about why they targeted these guys specifically. But his whole point, if you read the whole article, is that this is blowback from American France's policy in Syria, and that we don't need another Patriot Act. Yeah, what a crazy old coot that Ron Paul is. Good thing Matt Welch and Rand Paul are here to keep us safe from him, huh? You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. Our next guest today is Rory Fanning. He's got a new one at tomdispatch.com. We'll be running it tomorrow on antiwar.com. It's Rory Fanning, Unpacking the War on Terror. Also titled, you know how they do it at Tom Dispatch. Got a Nick Terse intro here. It's Letter to a Young Army Ranger from an Old One. Welcome to the show, Rory. How are you doing?
Terrific. Thanks for having me on the show.
Very happy to have you on. Very good article. I got a call about 2-3 weeks ago from someone, a friend of a friend, who their nephew was going to join up the Marine Corps. And they said, what do I do? It was someone who knew better but couldn't figure out how to make their nephew know better. And the best idea I had was give them the number to the Bill of Rights hotline and hope somebody there could recommend some good reading material. I know there's a good Chris Hedges book, What Everyone Should Know About War, that's, you know, very specific stuff about what it's like to be in battle and what it's like to be shot and what it's like to be in the Army and that these kinds of things. But I wasn't really sure what to tell him. I think if somebody asked me tomorrow, I'll probably have him read your article. But I wonder what your advice would be to that question, first of all, here.
Yeah, well, I've been wanting to write something like this for a long time. I mean, we have 10,000 recruiters stalking the hallways of our high schools, and they have a $700 million advertising budget to work with, and there really isn't a lot of pushback. I think it's only fair to have kids hear both sides, you know, particularly from someone who's actually been overseas and sees that we are actually not fighting for freedom or democracy around the world. If you're a high school age student, a lot of times you don't have a ton of options, and the military seems like the only option, but it's not the case. I don't think the rest of the world, you know, should have to pay for, our search for meaning, our search for, something to do with our lives. Mm-hmm. We've long since passed the time that we've been fighting for freedom and democracy around the world, and it's an involved discussion, and it's a nuanced discussion, I just like to have, we should have more of those conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny how even after the opinions of the wars have shifted pretty much, the job itself is always still sanctified in the minds of most people, because as you talk about in here, as you talk about, I think when you're describing your own feelings when you were joining up, that, hey, you, as far as you know, there's consensus for this. It's the right thing to do. You're defending the country from its enemies, and it's a rite of passage and this kind of thing. You see the commercials for it in every football game your entire life. So it's so very normal and part of life and very much an option for anyone turning 17 to start thinking about, really. And it all just kind of goes without saying, even still. And there doesn't seem to be too much challenge against it. You know, the actual shtick. Now, when it was the 90s and I was turning 17, 18, it was so-called peacetime. So it was a little bit easier sales pitch too. That, look, you'll go in, you'll do a few years, we'll make a real man out of you, and then you'll be able to get good work done and aim high and all that the rest of your life. But there's not too much risk that we're really going to make you kill somebody or that you're really going to get killed. It's just, you know, money for college. And push-ups and marksmanship,
right.
And because shooting rifles is fun, and so who doesn't want to do that? And so it's a little bit more complicated now. But as you say, they really narrow the discussion to a very narrow thing, right? To push-ups and marksmanship, and the guy on your left and your right. You say,
yeah. Well, we're entering the 14th year of the global war on terror. I mean, we've been spending on average $700 billion every single year to fight this war. You know, that money is not going towards sustainable energy. It's not going to education. It's not going to any kind of healthcare. And, you know, and plus we're killing hundreds of thousands of people. And we're certainly proven, you know, as we see the rise of ISIS, Taliban is as strong as it's ever been. There's nothing to show for any of this stuff. We're not going in there rebuilding any countries. I mean, right now, the Afghanistan is holding on by the skin of its teeth. We're funding its entire army. The second the U.S. pulls out its funding, that state is going to collapse. So what do we have to show for this? And why isn't there a critical discussion about the ineffectiveness of the U.S. military and the fact that we're actually creating the thing that we were being told we were sent to destroy? And that's more terrorism.
Yeah, and you know, you point out in the article, and this just blows me away to think about this, that when you were signing up and you were becoming an Army Ranger, being deployed to Afghanistan, the kids who are being deployed to Afghanistan as Rangers today were in kindergarten. They were going into kindergarten at the time that you were going into Afghanistan in 2002, and that's just mind-blowing. But what that means is, because it's gone on so long, that means that in their mind, this is kind of the ultimate of consensus, right? This is a consensus ongoing for a decade and a half that clearly this is the right thing to do. This is what we're doing. This is our mission, is to make Afghanistan better or something like that, right?
Right. I mean, they know nothing else. I mean, if you've been raised in the global war on terror, I mean, since, you know, when you're 17, that's all you've ever seen, you know, and we're being sent around the world to control other countries' natural resources, bottom line, and can ensure that the West controls those countries' resources. And making other countries poor, only a handful of people are benefiting from these wars, the richest of the rich. And yeah, the anti-war movement, unfortunately, is at a low point. And everybody thinks that the war on terror is being wrapped up. And we still have 10,000 troops over in Afghanistan. We just sent another 3,000 back into Iraq. You know, the special forces have basically conducted military operations in two-thirds of the world's countries since 9/11 and 49 of the 54 African countries. I mean, national sovereignty exists for no other country but the United States at this point. And, you know,
you gotta
start talking about that.
Yeah, now tell me, Rory, real quick here, if you could, what was the turning point for you? You make it really clear in this article. Again, it's at tomdispatch.com, letter to a young Army Ranger from an old one. You really were hook, line, and sinker into this thing. No insult intended here. That's as you write it. But what was it that made you, during your time, it was during your time in Afghanistan, you decided this is not for me. What was it?
Well, it was the level of poverty I saw for once. I mean, it felt like a bully. Here I was in the most powerful military on the planet, rolling into one of the most poorest countries on Earth. You know, it was pretty clear we were acting on horrible intelligence. We were little more than pawns in village disputes most of the time, and we were actually trying to draw the enemy back into the fight. The Taliban largely surrendered after the initial assault in 2001. And unfortunately, our politics, that wasn't good enough for our chain of command. They wanted wanted to give the American public more blood. And so we probably drew him back into the fight. And so it was pretty clear to me that I wasn't doing anything for the world. I was only making it more dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I think it's great that you're doing this kind of writing and that, as it says here, you do all this great work going around and doing counter recruitment and trying to get through to people here. I remember being young, and it can be very difficult for people to accept that, well, wait a minute. I mean, you're really telling me the consensus of my parents, my coaches, my teachers, my church elders, that they're wrong and that actually this, you know, code pink view of the world is the one that's actually more accurate about what's going on in these wars. And that can be strange and unsettling to people to think that, oh yeah, no, really, it's really not true what they've been telling you. So of course it makes it much more powerful when it's somebody who walks in and says, hey, I was a ranger and I was over there. And so I'm not kidding here. You know, you need to listen up. I think it's very important, the work that you're doing. So thank you for it, you know?
Yeah, my pleasure. People are interested in having me come talk to their high school. They can email me at walkforpat@gmail.com.
Walk for Pat. Oh yeah. Because, well, we're already into the break, so tell that story real quick. You walked across the country. What's that about?
Pat Till and I served in the same unit, and
I didn't realize that. Or if I knew that, it was a long time ago. I'm sorry. I said I didn't realize that, or maybe I did, but it was a long time ago. But I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, we can talk about it next time.
Sure.
I walked across from Virginia Beach to San Diego to raise $3.6 million that Pat gave up. So. Years ago. Yeah. So anyway, call me next time. We can talk more.
Okay. Well, thanks, Rory. I really appreciate it.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye.
Okay, y'all. That's Rory Fanning. And the book is Worth Fighting For, An Army Ranger's Journey Out of the Military and Across America. Came out last year. And here he is at TomDispatch.com. And the article is Unpacking the War on Terror, Letter to a Young Army Ranger from an Old One. And already I see in the chat room a relative is getting this article. So this kind of thing is very important. Anybody else out there have something to say along these lines? Do that. We'll be right back. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast Peace Talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And next up is Roy Gutman from McClatchy Newspapers, reporting from Turkey. Hey, Roy, how are you doing?
Okay, fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us back on the show here. And lots of news to cover with you here. First of all, tell us about this airstrike in Syria. You say here that at least 50 Syrian civilians were killed. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes. I mean, I wasn't there, but that's what witnesses in the town are saying. The town is called Al-Bab. It's not far from the Turkish border, north of Aleppo. And there was an airstrike there on the 28th of December. It was never announced by the Central Command or by the Joint Task Force, but local people reported it out to a young fellow we have as a stringer inside of Syria. And then I went to the Central Command and I asked them about it. I said, you know, people are saying that there was an airstrike, that a major building in the town was leveled, and that there were a lot of people inside who There were members of the Islamic State, you know, the extreme radical group, who were there as guards, but they had turned this building into a jail, and they were holding civilians. And there were, according to local people, at least 50 civilians were killed.
And mostly just people being held in the jail there, huh?
Well, you know, the Islamic State has its own idea of justice. Their version of Sharia or Islamic religious law is an extreme one. And so you can be arrested for wearing jeans, for smoking. You can be arrested for arriving at the mosque too late for the afternoon prayers. You can be arrested for insulting them in public or for talking back to them in public, and you can be held indefinitely by them in their jail. And this is one of the jails that they set up. Other people were held, and I think most of those people ordinarily would be released after a period of time. But then there's a second group who are fighters from the rebel forces that, you know, are the moderate rebel forces who have been getting America backing. Or from other groups fighting the regime. And those people are held, and very often they're executed in the public square. So it's a really terrible regime, as everybody knows. One of the, maybe the most dangerous and nasty regime on earth.
Yeah. Well, and hell, even if it's a building full of real felons, that doesn't mean it's okay to bomb it and have America serving as ISIS's executioners over people arrested, you know, especially over nothing like you're describing. But even if it was some murderers, it still doesn't make it right to bomb them like that.
I mean, I have to assume that the Central Command has not conceded that they did kill civilians. They do not acknowledge it. They are investigating it. Certainly, after I contacted them, and we'll have to see what they come up with. Mm. I don't think there was anything intentional about it. I mean, they were hitting a building that had been commandeered by the Islamic State.
Mm. They just probably had incomplete intelligence about what was going on there, right?
Absolutely. That's the rub, because one of the reasons they have incomplete intelligence throughout northern Syria is that they're refusing to talk to their own allies about where the Islamic State is located, you know, where they have their buildings. This has been going on now since September, that the U.S. has been bombing, but it has been bombing without any consultation with their allied forces on the ground. And so it's likely that they will make mistakes in that situation and that circumstance. It's almost made, you know, it's meant to happen. And I think it's a disastrous thing when it does happen.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, the fact that they didn't announce it, is that interesting to you? Because they typically do say, we dropped this many bombs on Mosul today and this many bombs on Raqqa, right?
Well, it's very troubling. I don't know how to explain it, and that's all I can say about it, because I had to go back to them maybe four or five times and ask them, would you please check and double check and triple check, because I'm very confident of the information I've got. And finally they came back to me about four or five days later, and they said, you know, full of apologies, and they said, we're really sorry, we didn't get this answer sooner, we're very sorry that we didn't announce this at the time it happened. They said it was an administrative error, and I guess one has to accept that on face value until proven otherwise. Now, the problem is, Scott, that I think there are other cases of bombings which have not been announced. And, you know, the only way I can check them out as a reporter is one by one. So I've sent them a request on a second bombing that is said to have occurred the same day as this one, which is the 28th of December. And I said, you know, the local civic activists, even though this is under the control of the Islamic State and there's zero freedom in that circumstance, still local civic activists have reported that there was a bombing in the second town. And I said, could you please check this one out? Now, I don't have quite all the evidence in the second town that I did in the town of El Bab. I don't have a photograph, for example, I don't have a death toll. I don't have anything like that. The building they hit there was a headquarters of the Islamic State, and it, supposedly it was not a jail. It was just a headquarters. So I don't think you have the civilian death toll there. But nevertheless, it's the second case of a bombing that was not announced. And anyway, so I got in touch with him on this. I think it was Sunday, and here it is Tuesday. I haven't heard back, but I assume that they are going through the checking process. And if it's true, I'll have to write another story. But quite frankly, there are other cases beyond that, because you know, we monitor the Syrian various social media very closely, and we've heard about other cases. So I you know, this is a story still in progress.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, they told Central Command, I think it was, or somebody at the Pentagon told Vice magazine just 2 weeks ago, week and a half ago, Roy, that, oh, you know, we don't know of any civilian casualties that we've caused this whole time. We're doing such a great job at this. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that whoever said that really went way beyond their level of knowledge, because I believe it was the spokesman for the Pentagon, Admiral Kirby, last week, who said just about a week ago today that they've had reports of civilian casualties. They're investigating them. They truly want to avoid them, et cetera, and so on. Now, you know, he didn't give any numbers. He didn't say how many cases are being investigated. But I know myself from last September, when the very first bombings occurred in Syria by the U.S. At the time, that a number of civilians were killed in Idlib province. I think it's about 10 or 12 on that order, on that very day. And I reported it that day. I don't recall anybody ever disputing the report. Maybe they didn't notice it, but it was a very carefully written report. And so that's at least a dozen. And I've heard from a Syrian human rights group who monitor the war very closely, that the total number that they estimate, that they've collected from all over Syria since September 23rd, is 40.
All right, now.
And I believe, this is a group that is very conscientious and really, you know, they get names. They don't just
right.
Numbers.
All right, I'm sorry. I got to stop you here so we can take this break, but we'll be right back, everybody. It's Roy Gutman from McClatchy Newspapers reporting from Turkey.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Talking with Roy Gutman from McClatchy Newspapers out of Turkey. And now, Roy, I want to go back a little while to, geez, maybe even a couple of months ago. I think maybe 2 or 3 months ago. I was trying to get you on the show, and I think it never did work out. And it was about, or maybe I just talked with Lande about it and so checked it off the list. And it was your report about how the CIA was cutting off the Free Syrian Army in the north, or actually they were taking over control of their Free Syrian Army brigades directly in the north and the south of Syria, and cutting out the entire bureaucratic establishment of the Free Syrian Army based in Turkey, who, I guess, you know, they just sit in their hotels and smoke cigars or whatever all day. But then, so whatever happened with that?
Well, what happened was, first of all, it isn't quite the way you put it, but close. The CIA started up a program, a covert aid program, although it was not a well-kept secret, at the beginning of last year. And they, instead of going through the structure of the opposition forces, they call themselves the coalition, government in exile, or interim government, instead of going through them and their defense minister and the staff that they set up, the military staff, the CIA went directly to commanders and started and told them, you know, you come in with your proposal for what you're going to do in the next month, and we'll give you money. And so they circumvented an entire command structure. I wouldn't say it was the greatest command structure in the world, but it was a command structure. And you need that kind of thing in any kind of in any military. And so they basically created a group of warlords as a process. And they made it impossible to coordinate anything bigger, anything broader, anything, strategic. So this last, and it was a disastrous time for them to do that very thing, but this is what the Obama administration decided to do. And the reason it was such a huge disaster was last year was the rise of the Islamic State. They really were very strong in northern Syria, but at the beginning of the year, the opposition forces, the rebel forces, the pro-Western forces, destroyed the bases of the Islamic State and kicked them out of much of northern Syria. So you had a success, an incredible, unexpected, unfunded, but spontaneously run operation, which led to something that was a very, very positive outcome from the Western and the American perspective. But because the American government was supporting these commanders individually, without any staff, without any strategy, without any thinking, there was no way to build on that success. And instead, what happened was by creating a group of warlords, they basically divided up the battlefield and micromanaged it and manipulated it. So later in the year, when the bombing began, the U.S. started bombing the Islamic State in Syria, and the Al-Qaeda, what do we call it, the Al-Qaeda extension in northern Syria, namely the Nusra Front, they call themselves, they did it without consulting even the warlords that they were supporting, and they made big mistakes. They bombed places, they killed civilians, and they alienated this group of commanders from the basic support they had in the public. They had some big setbacks in the month of November. The radicals gained. The moderates lost. The outcome was a lot of territory switched hands that had been in moderate hands and then went into radical hands. And at that point, instead of trying to build up the forces and sort of learn the lessons of the year, the U.S. decided to punish them, basically, and cut off support. Certainly to all the groups that lost territory, but in addition, they suspended aid to some of the groups that didn't lose territory. It was a completely upside-down approach. For the life of me, I can't get anybody in the administration to explain it. They don't even answer the phone. They don't answer any questions. But that's what happened. So there was a cutoff, a severe cutoff in the month of December. Some of that aid has now been restored. I don't know quite how much. After I wrote my story and I was quoting individual commanders and I was quoting officials of the coalition, the U.S. government went to them and it looks like they threatened them in some way that if they ever talked to a reporter again, certainly on the record, that everything would be cut off for all time. So it's very hard to report that story. But I do know that, they say, in general, there was a major cutoff in the north of Syria in early December. There was a restoration to some degree, I gather, early this month.
Hmm. All right. Now, so which groups are we talking about here when we talk about the so-called moderates? Is moderation simply a function of being willing to meet with CIA officers, or how do you measure that?
The battlefield is full of groups. The whole Syrian revolution was spontaneous. It was, ground up. It was not organized at the top. There's still no real leader has emerged. And so you have at first, and then the Assad regime went after them using its army. So this led to the creation of armed resistance throughout the country, mostly locally based. And at the beginning, they were supported, and they originated in the towns and the cities and the valleys and the and the villages that they came from. So they were locally based.
Well, but then all the veterans of the last war in Iraq, of the Sunni-based insurgency, the Iraqi and the Syrian veterans, started waging holy jihad by, you know, early summer 2011, al-Nusra, and then ISIS.
They saw that there was a vacuum, because while the government could not run, it was at least half of the country that they had lost control of, neither could these homegrown groups. And so al-Qaeda saw the opportunity and sent people from Iraq and then collected more people, was able to raise money, and other radical groups sprang out of all of this chaos. And so now, when I say moderate groups, what I'm saying is that these are the secular groups, the groups that are not preaching a religious state, who want free elections, who want democracy, or at least they say they do. I mean, we don't know until they get a chance to get in power, if they ever do.
Yeah. But Roy, you know,
they do exist.
There are plenty of stories, though, about the FSA also beheading people, even if it's al-Nusra and ISIS prisoners they're beheading. There they are beheading them. And, you know, we got the Al-Farouk Brigade. They had called for elections. David Enders, your colleague, former colleague, had told this story about how, yeah, they had called for elections, the Al-Farouk Brigade. But that was their commander that was on film eating the guy's heart or liver or whatever it was. And then you had the Northern Storm Brigade that John McCain met with. But then they had told Time magazine, yeah, we're veterans of the Iraq War where we fought against the Americans. They're right there on video saying so. And so... you know, Patrick Coburn says when he's in Turkey and he talks with representatives of all of these groups, they're all pro 9/11. They're all pro war with America, and they all are more or less al-Nusra guys, no matter how you slice it.
I think Patrick does some very interesting reporting, but he really doesn't doesn't discriminate very closely. The commanders that I'm referring to specifically are the ones who were vetted, who were approved, who were trained, and who were equipped by the CIA, and they made it through the hurdles because the CIA determined that they were none of those that you just mentioned, that they were not that they were trustworthy, and they had not joined any jihad. So there were at least a dozen or 14 or 15 at most commanders who passed through all those hurdles. Those are the ones that I've been writing about.
I see. But
there are others as well. But I have to disagree with the gist of what you're saying, because I think that there are many people there. Look, Syrians, my experience, and I've met so many people in displaced persons camps as refugees in Syria, out of Syria. I've met so many of them. Syrians are not crazy. They are not jihadists in their aspirations. They are, there are many, 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 probably the vast majority are normal people who want just simply a decent life.
Well, you can say the same thing about the Iraqi Sunnis, too. I mean, they're not from Saudi Arabia either, and yet they're ruled by Baghdadi now. So,
well, you know, it's politics. The politics leads to these things. It leads to radicals taking over. And the problem in Syria is that the U.S. government recognized, almost all security agencies recognized more than 2 years ago, that if the U.S. supported moderates, not everybody who's going to be a perfect moderate, but that there were moderates to be supported, that would be the biggest card that the U.S. could play. But the White House rejected it. I mean, you had the CIA, you had the Department of Defense, and you had the State Department, all urging Obama to take one course. And Obama went the other way. He decided to give them the minimal backing to bring the CIA into it, and as I say, the rest of it is the history of last year, and it's a disastrous history.
Although, but when you say that, you're neglecting to mention that means Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus came up with this, so that's not the same as, it was the consensus of the whole government or anything like that. I mean, take a counterexample, for example. We armed up the Shiite army of Iraq, the avowed enemies of the Islamic State in every way forever, and yet they turn around and ran and left all their weapons behind for the Islamic State to get. After training them up and spending tens and tens of billions of dollars building that army over a decade. But here we're supposed to train up some guys who have the exact same goals as the al-Nusra Front,
but just aren't the El Nusra Front because they've been vetted. And we're going to give these guys enough guns and enough bombs and enough money that they're going to be able to take on Assad and Nusra and the Islamic State, Roy? I mean, come on.
Well, you know, you have constructed a scenario there that suggests Syria is bound, we should do nothing about it, that it is bound to become a radical jihadist state. You know, I happen to think that a jihadist, even a micro-state, like the Islamic State now, and they call themselves a caliphate, is an absolute disaster for Western interests, for U.S. interests.
Oh, no, I agree with that. I just think it's a problem more likely to resolve itself than have America come in and build up this kind of army, which they were unable to do in Iraq, even though they were building it out of the Ba'ath Brigade, which hates the Islamic State. You know what I mean? Are you understand what I'm saying here? Where you're talking about basically like doing an awakening type movement where you hire all friendly Sunni tribal guys to take on the jihadists and Assad in the middle of a civil war with the secular Ba'athist coalition of everybody else in the country.
Well, you have to begin by defining the problem. The problem is it's a security vacuum. It's the case in both Iraq and in Syria. And the security problem, the security vacuum in Iraq came about in large part because the U.S. exited Iraq at a time that was really before it should have left there. And it's a whole different story about why that happened. But it happened, and there was a vacuum. And the Maliki government, instead of trying to create or sustain an army that was multi-ethnic, multinational, went for a Shia-only army and destroyed the army. But when the U.S. left, I don't think it was in that condition. It was our absence that really allowed that to happen. And likewise, if you have a security vacuum in Syria that is the result of an uprising against a regime that everybody agrees is dictatorial and cruel and really willing to kill all of its own people, you know, that created a vacuum. So my point is define the problem and then define the solution. And I don't think you're going to get to that solution very quickly.
Yeah.
But the solution in both places is you have to have security, you have to have moderates running it, and you've got to find some way to support that. And the one thing you should never do is walk away from it. And that's what the U.S. government did in Iraq, and that's what it's doing now in Syria.
Then again, they didn't have to invade and regime change the country in 2003. So let's not leave out. If Uday and Qusay were here, then Baghdadi would be dead. Right.
Well, of course, that was the original sin. But the problem is, if you're the president of the United States, or if you have an administration that follows the one that did this invasion, you've got to accept the world as it is, and you've got to move on. You've got to work with what you have.
Well, but you know, you also skipped the part where the side that we fought for, that we won, and that we put in power, they were the ones who told us to leave, and George Bush had to sign. Bush was pushing for 56 permanent bases, and Maliki told him no, 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 and Bush signed on the dotted line in 2008 and said, okay, the guys that we helped win the capital city and the democracy and everything else are telling us thanks a lot, now beat it. So what were we supposed to do, reinvade and insist?
No, but I was in Iraq in 2011 when all the negotiations were going on about extending the American presence. Put it this way, the absence of the American forces who were doing, by that point, they really had learned their job terrifically, and they were doing a very solid job, and they were really necessary. The absence of the American forces created, led to the vacuum. And then you also had the stupidity of Maliki. I mean, who filled the vacuum? Put it this way. It was Iran. That's what has led to the disaster of last year, namely of ISIS taking over. It was Iran. Who is running the show in Syria right now? Who has filled the vacuum in Syria? It is Iran. So, you know, we have to look at, you know, name things by their proper names and accept there's a vacuum.
It's been filled
by people who have no no interest in a stable, moderate state. And you have to decide, if you're the president of the United States, whether you want to accept that. And if you don't, you have to then define a goal and a way of getting to the goal. And so all of the history that you correctly cited is relevant, but it doesn't tell you what to do next.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so let me ask you this, and I'll let you go. I'm sorry I'm already keeping you over time, but since it was America's policy to choose Iran's favorite groups, the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, to fight for from 2003 through 11, first Jafari, who's now the foreign minister, first Jafari, then Maliki, and now Abadi, all three of them from the Dawa Party. And since we knew all along that it was the Iranians' interest to split Iraq up, that they just wanted a strong, quote, federal system, like Sadr was always denouncing them for, and that they didn't want to try to rule Sunnistan. They didn't want to try to rule Anbar and Mosul and Fallujah and Bakuba, because that was basically foreign territory. They just wanted to run off with Shiistan. And that was the policy that America supported in supporting their guys. And so now we're still, now that the Islamic State has risen up, now we have America fighting as the air cover. In one specific case, actually, that town of Amirli, where you had Quds Force fighting on the ground and American air cover, and which is a great metaphor for the entire war that's now going on, still for the last 12 years running now, America fighting for Iran and Iraq. Well, at the same time, as you were implying there, America is against Assad, who is working for Iran and on the Shiite side of this civil war in Syria. So, you know, if ISIS is really the enemy and we have to do something, wouldn't it make more sense for America to be consistent with George Bush and Barack Obama's Iraq policy and go ahead and back the Shiite government in alliance with Iran in Syria against the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front? The Islamic State, which is the new holy terror, and the Nusra Front, which is sworn loyal to Zawahiri, the butcher of New York City. And what has Assad ever done to America other than torture these guys for George W. Bush when he asked him to, even if they were innocent men?
Well, you know, to give you a one-word answer to a very complex question, the answer is no, hell no. Listen, you have to remember the Syrian uprising was a national uprising. It came from the ground up. It was not led from outside. It was an attempt to bring a, you know, people wanted the slogan was, we want our dignity, we want our own government, we want elections. Now, of course, a lot of water has flowed down the Orontes River since then, but the fact is that was the goal, and you cannot go, if you're wise at least, your policy should never be to fight the people when they are in a national uprising for a more modern state. I mean, that's a crazy thing to do. And Assad has demonized that group, and he did everything he could, in fact, to encourage and to allow the Islamic extremists to come in. You know, all of last year, when the Islamic State, then they call themselves Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, was running a little state within a state in the town of Raqqa, Assad never bombed them. He never did anything to them. He was quite happy to have them there, it seems, at least judging from. Instead, he was out there bombing civilians. And you have to understand that, Scott, that civilians have been decimated by this regime. He has destroyed half of Aleppo. He has destroyed city after city and village after village. And I talked yesterday to some children who had been victims of. I was in the town of Kilis, near the border with Syria, and they had been victims of barrel bombs. You know, he's dropping these indiscriminate weapons on civilians and killing children and parents, and there's no military purpose for it, no military objective to be hit there. You have to understand this is the guy who says he's against terrorism, but as a matter of fact, did a hell of a lot to let it grow in his country, and maybe even encouraged it. In fact, I have a series of articles that I hope come out soon that will give that history. So I don't think that that's a pseudo. I mean, you know, I'm not in power. I'm just a journalist. But looking at it from the outside, I think that is hardly a suitable ally.
Yeah, well, of course, I'm for complete non-intervention here. It just seems kind of crazy that this whole time we've been supporting a revolution, which includes friends of Osama. You know, I have the clip here. I won't bore you with it. I'm sure you've probably seen it. It's Hillary Clinton, and it is, in a sense, a figure of speech. I'll concede that. But it's Hillary in March of 2012. And the question is being put to her by CBS News, why aren't we doing more to help the rebels there? And she, in explaining, you know, the obviously she wanted to do more, as we already discussed, but Obama's reluctance, and she's toeing his line because he's the president. And so defending the policy of not doing more, but doing some, she says, listen, Ayman al-Zawahiri has endorsed this revolution. Are we supporting al-Qaeda in Syria? We have to be very careful about this. And when we look at opposition figures that we can really rely on, we don't really see that. And in fact, she tried in 2012 two different times to put together coalition governments that all both turned around immediately and endorsed the al-Nusra Front in their, as covered in McClatchy newspapers, in their desperate bids at street credibility. They had to endorse al-Qaeda in Syria to even try to be, to even try to pretend to be the new government there. And so, no, I'm not saying we should support the Baathists there, but it sounds like what you're saying is we should basically do what everyone agrees is the worst mistake of the Iraq War other than starting it, which was de-Baathifying the government and abolishing the Iraqi army. You're saying that that's what we should do in Syria, de-Baathify the government, get rid of its evil totalitarian army, no disputing, just like Saddam Hussein's government, no disputing it's a fascist military dictatorship that murders innocent people. No one ever argued otherwise. But you're saying that we should de-Baathify the government and abolish the army when not leading up to and oops causes a bin Ladenite jihad, but in the middle of one. And that to me sounds a little bit insane, right? No?
I hope I'm not being taken as advocating one course or another, because it's not my job to advocate a course of action. But I can tell you courses of action that are going to lead to disaster, and one of them is making an alliance with Assad. And the reason that it would lead to a disaster, I'm not saying there are good choices here, and in life there are often, you know, bad choices, worse choices, and still worse choices. Yeah.
And I agree with you, by the way, on this.
You know, you've got to pick the least worst, because that's you have to be pragmatic.
Oh, I don't agree with that.
I just wanted
to be clear that I agree with your part about we should not ally with Assad. I think that's just as bad as allying with Iran and the Badr Brigade in Iraq, which is horrible. I'm totally against it. I'm against intervening on any side of this.
Well, on the other hand, if you look at the world and you see an immense vacuum and you see that terrorists are filling that vacuum, you know they're going to come after you at some point. So whether you want to intervene or not, there's really not a lot of choices there, because letting that we've seen this in Afghanistan in the 1990s. Do you really want to have a repeat of 9/11, which is what that led to?
Well, but it wasn't non-intervention that caused 9/11. It was support for Israel and the occupation of the Saudi Arabian desert to wage the blockade and the no-fly zone bombings over Iraq that whole time. You've read the fatwa, you know.
Well, listen, I've written a book about Afghanistan in the 1990s, and the basic fact is that the Bin Laden created a state within a state, and in fact, my argument is that he hijacked the state in so doing. And the U.S. response was to throw some cruise missiles at him. Mm-hmm. And I think the lesson of Afghanistan, the major lesson, should be that you cannot allow this kind of an enormous security vacuum to develop, as did in Afghanistan, and to have it filled by a state within a terrorist state within a state. That's what's happened right now. It's what happened in Afghanistan in the 1990s is what's happening now in Syria, and what's happened as well as in Iraq. And it seems to me that whether we like whatever course of action we want to take or would prefer to take if we had our choice, and non-intervention is obviously a preferred way than intervention. The fact is we should have learned our lesson from Afghanistan, and I don't think we have. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, this has been a very interesting discussion, and even though we disagree on some of this stuff, I really like you, Roy, and I think you do good reporting, and I really appreciate your time on the show.
Well, Scott, I must say, you are so well-informed. It's delightful to chat with you and to have a discussion with you. So anytime.
Okay. Well, appreciate it. Talk to you again.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
All right, so that's Roy Gutman. He's at McClatchyDC.com reporting right now out of Turkey.